We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From WILL, Illinois Public Media, this is Focus. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. Our technical director is Jason Croft. Today we open the phone lines for questions about computers. We've taken this topic from the Afternoon Magazine and moved it to Focus. We'll talk about computers on Focus on the first Thursday of the month. Debbie Flieger and Jim Eyrick of CITES are with us this morning. CITES is the acronym for Campus Information Technologies and Educational Services at the University of Illinois. Debbie is Principal Research Programmer at CITES. Jim is Wireless Network Designer at CITES. Listeners, you can join us with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu, will-talk@illinois.edu. Good morning. It's good to see the two of you. How are you?
Morning.
Good.
Good. Okay. Well, before we really get into the nitty-gritty of questions about computers, I wanted to mention that coming up Saturday, there is an opportunity for Champaign County residents to drop off unwanted or old electronics for environmentally sound recycling or refurbishing and reuse with no components ending up in a landfill. This will take place this Saturday, August 7th, from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m., rain or shine, the collection location is the News Gazette Distribution Center at 3202 Apollo Drive in Champaign. And I will have more information on this event during the Afternoon Magazine today. Following weather, I'll talk with Courtney Rushforth. She's the recycling coordinator for the city of Urbana. So that's Champaign County residents, an opportunity to drop off unwanted or old electronics items for environmentally sound recycling or refurbishing and reuse. And chances are we all have something like that in the house that we could get rid of.
I know I do. I'm going to say I went there last year, and I've heard some bad things in the past years about some of the drop-offs with big long lines. This thing was really well run. It was streamlined. You drove through. You pulled up to a spot, and a bunch of people came up to your car, lifted all the stuff out for you. It was great.
Yeah,
they're
calling
really smooth.
They're calling it a pit row style, I guess. It moves very quickly now.
Yes. Yeah. I was very impressed, actually, when we dropped stuff off last year.
Okay, so very good. Well, if we've got something to drop off, say I have an old computer I want to get rid of, how do I wipe out the data on the hard drive before I drive into the collection site?
Well, that's an excellent question, and it depends on what kind of computer you have. It's a little bit different for the different computers, just which programs are available to do that.
In general, most machines that can run Windows, you can use a program. It's called Derek Boot and Nuke. That's Derek, D-A-R-I-K. You download it, you make a CD-ROM, put it in the old machine, boot off that CD, and then you can pick which level, depending on how much time you want it to spend of wiping that you want it to do. It'll do all the way up to what it says are military-grade disk erasure, which can take multiple days. And then there's also the quick ones that take a few hours. And then Max, I think you end up, I'm not sure what utilities for Max.
Well, the easiest one is if you got the disk that came with your computer, if you boot to that, as if you were going to reinstall your computer, one of the options is to erase the hard drive. And it has a few different choices in that, whether you erase it by covering it in zeros or just erase it. And if you're getting rid of it, I suggest running at least one pass of erasing it with zeros and ones. Nine was the state law for a while and is over excessive. Almost everything's gone after two passes, is it?
I think so.
Something along those orders. So it depends on how worried you are, what kind of data you had on you, how many times you run that erase program. But you can just, if you've got the disks that came with your computer, you can do that. I know there's some other options for Mac, but I don't, off the top of my head, I think you'd have to just look in Google and see what you could find.
The startup disk's actually the last one I used.
It works very well.
when you're in the middle of startup, you can go to utilities, I think, and disk utility, and then pick a race.
Yeah, I guess that would be the thing to say, is it brings up the install me screen and ignore the screen and go up to the menus.
Right.
And in the menus, there's a choice for disk utility.
Okay. And if all else fails, if you can't get, like, you can't get the CD-ROM to boot, whether it's a Mac or a PC, what I've done in the past is, and my family asked me, oh, I got rid of my old computer or whatever, is like, just take out the hard drive, put it on a shelf. It's, you know, fairly small. It doesn't take up a lot of space. Take the rest of it, and we can deal with the hard drive later. Mm. You know, I've actually gone to the point where you take a drill and actually drill a hole through it and physically damage the drive. But if you want somebody to reuse it, then you'll need to erase it and give it with it.
Right. And that's the best thing, if somebody can reuse it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And there is the issue comes up in terms of the recycling event here. The contractor that they have can't assume responsibility for any information left in a hard drive. That, of course, makes sense. But they also do use data wiping software or a hardware shredding process. So probably the best thing to do is to take care of that on your own. But
sure.
It sounds like they're going to try.
They're going to try, yeah. Well, we've got a listener who's calling in this morning from Urbana, and let's go and talk with this listener. Line one, hi.
Hi. Does the computer science department still support a listserv? The question came up at a PCUG meeting recently, and we weren't quite sure.
Well, do they support a specific listserv or just have a listserv server? What were you thinking?
Well, yes, do you have a listserv server? And is there one open to university groups?
Sites does. I don't know if the CS department does or not. But,
okay.
But Sites does run a listserv server, and university groups, anybody on the university can ask for a listserv.
I see.
There's a number of student organizations have listservs on there. A number of university groups have listservs on there. And it's listserv.sites.
There'd be a minimum requirement that all the officers would be university affiliated, I imagine.
I actually don't know. As long as as long as your group is a university group and meets the university rules, I don't think Sites is going to ask.
Well, thanks for the information. We weren't quite sure. We actually had moved our listserv over to Google Lists, which fulfills our requirements, but I can imagine other groups that might prefer to be on a university server. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call this morning. This is Focus, and today we have the phone lines open for questions about computers. Debbie Flieger and Jim Eirich of Sites are with us this morning. Sites is Campus Information Technologies and Educational Services. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. No one waiting at the moment, so if you've got a question, no time like the present to join us. Maybe we could talk a little bit about browsers this morning. Extremely basic question here. What is a browser?
Well, there's all this stuff out on the internet, and people want to get that stuff.
Uh-huh.
And so, in the early 90s, some folks thought, well, you know, if you write your stuff in a certain way, and I write a program that knows how to read that, and everybody agrees, people can find the stuff easier. And that's really what a web browser is. It's the program that everybody's agreed to write their information they want to share in a certain way, and a web browser lets you view that data.
Okay. So Internet Explorer is one. Mozilla, Firefox, Safari, Google Chrome, those are all.
Those Opera. Are all. What else? There's got to be a whole bunch of others.
Opera was about the last one I could think of after that list.
Yeah. So what browser do you prefer, Debbie?
I use Safari most of the time.
Uh-huh.
There's a handful of things that don't work as well in Safari that I fire up Mozilla for. Internet Explorer is the last resort of things that are PC only. But mostly that's because I sit in front of a Mac most of the time, so it's a pain to find Internet Explorer, not because it's inherently terribly evil or anything like that, because it's just another browser. So they all work pretty well. Each of them is a little bit different and mm-hmm. has kind of a different feel to it, different defaults, and you kind of got to look around for what you want, you know, which kind of setup matches what you're interested in.
And there's plugins, which Safari just now has started to support, I think, recently. Plugins add functionality to the browser. Maybe it's the Google toolbar, things like that. I'm a Firefox person almost exclusively. I use Internet Explorer again when I'm interacting with something that requires tight integration with like Windows Active Directory on campus, things like that. Sometimes Internet Explorer just works better for that. But in general, I'm a Firefox person. And
okay. Well, I have some other questions about browsers. We can go back to that in a minute. But in the meantime, let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Yeah, is that me?
That's you.
Okay. I've had this ongoing problem that whenever I buy a new computer, it works fine for a while, but then gradually things start to become slower and slower, launching different applications and launching programs, and sometimes it's programs just on the computer, Outlook or Word, but sometimes it's things like the web browser and finding a particular website. And I guess my question is, what is the reason for that? Is it the accumulation of a lot of little files that have been written by various things that have interacted with me, some without my knowledge over time? And if so, would it help to simply reformat the hard drive and reload all the programs, including the operating system?
Well, my first question is what exact the time frame that you're talking about that it slows down? Are we talking years or months?
Years.
Okay, so in years, one of the main things, and there's not much you can actually do about this, is that during those years, you're getting updates for your operating system and you're getting updates for your programs.
Okay.
And those programs and those updates are basing the resources they need on the continuing evolution of more PC power at your desktop. But your machine is frozen, the amount of power it has is frozen in when it was purchased.
Yeah.
So as these programs and these designers go, well, we have the new Core 2 processors or the Core I processors, we can make our program do this now. Mm-hmm. Well, that's great for the people that just bought a brand new computer, but if that program updates on your computer, it just slows down.
I see.
So part of it will be just the operating system and the programs getting larger and expecting more processor power to be available. There are other things where certainly it used to be a problem. I don't really have people spend much time with this anymore. Would be hard drive defragging, where you basically reorder all the files in your hard drive and reorganize them.
Yeah, I tried that. It didn't do much good.
Right. The other thing you could do is as you over years you are adding a lot of programs to your computer, you may not be cleaning them up.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes go in. I'm assuming Windows. If it's Mac, then I'll just send you over to Debbie.
Yeah,
but
Windows.
In Windows, would go to the control panel and go to add remove programs and just start. And not just start, I guess, would be bad. You could end up in a place you don't want to be. But see the programs that you go, yeah, I remember installing that, and I don't use that anymore.
Okay.
Uninstall those programs. And then anything that's in the bottom right-hand side by the clock, called the SysTray, every one of those icons is stealing a little bit of memory and a little bit of CPU from your computer.
I see.
Some of them you want down there. You want things like your antivirus to show up down
mm-hmm.
there. You may have like Microsoft's anti-spyware stuff or somebody else's anti-spyware program. Those are fine. But then you end up with things like a lot of printers put utilities down there. In general, those aren't really needed unless you want the thing to come up and say, hey, by the way, you're out of ink. You need to buy some.
Uh-huh.
They're not... Normally, I would say that those utilities aren't very useful for anything else.
Okay.
The other thing to look for is I've seen things like photo programs like Kodak. It'll come with, this will come with like a digital camera or a printer driver or a printer that you purchase. Those are also taking memory from you. And if you can find those and add remove programs, and if you don't use it, then remove it. And you will find that you're going to get speed back on your machine.
Okay, so this is basically a problem with the... with a CPU rather than the hard drive, because I've got less than a quarter of my hard drive filled, used.
Right.
And I'm nowhere near the capacity of it, so it's not that then. So reformatting the hard drive isn't going to do any good.
Well, reformatting the hard drive will seem that it did things good because you'll get rid of all these programs
all
that you've accumulated.
Programs. Okay, I see. Yeah.
In general, it'll be CPU and memory. It's not going to be, unless your system is, you're almost completely full,
yeah,
then the hard drive is most likely not the issue.
Okay.
it depends on what the cost of memory is and how old the machine is. If you find, you can look to, in Windows, you can do Control-Alt-Delete and then go to Task Manager.
Okay.
You can actually see how much memory is being used. If you're finding that you're using most of your physical RAM, then it would be worth investigating, finding out how much it costs
to
double the RAM or to put in another 50% RAM.
I see.
But you need to compare that to the cost of a new machine and the utility that you'll get from a new machine.
Okay. All right, those are all good thoughts. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call this morning. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. The email address will-talk@illinois.edu. Any difference there, Debbie, when it comes to Apple?
No, not a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some small things that are similar, that just slightly different because the Apple does it just a little bit different, but basically it's all the same.
Yeah.
If it's older, it's slower, and every company just says, oh, I should be able to use all this much more memory and this much more CPU. And so if you're running the new programs on the old computer, it'll seem slower.
Yeah. I have a Safari question for you. It seems to be several weeks ago now, I updated Safari, and then it hasn't been performing very well for me, and so I've been relying more and more on Mozilla Firefox.
Well, I think it was just last week they released the Safari 5.0.1 upgrade.
Okay, so maybe what I need to do is do another upgrade, huh?
I'd check that that first, because usually when you go from 5.0.0 to 5.0.1, it's because they found a problem or two.
Okay.
Any .0 release is always interesting to use, even from the best test software and the best people in the world. Much less, places that get stuff out real fast. That's one of those universal truths. Running the .0 version of anything always has its own set of risks. I have had a few weird things happen in the last month or two, and the stuff was under the Safari menu. There's a choice for empty cache, and it brought up a list of different things to empty. Or actually, no, that just is the cache part. There was one right above it called Reset Safari. And it has a bunch of check marks, things like clear history, reset top sites, but it's also got like empty the cache and remove all cookies and remove autofill forms and reset location warnings. I'm like, boy. And I unchecked some of the ones I knew I didn't want to do, like clear history and reset top sites, and I let it do a lot of the rest, like empty the cache and remove the cookies. And now there's a lot of places I've had to type my password back in because I removed the cookies.
Uh-huh.
So up front, you got to know your passwords before you do that. But everything has gotten better. And so I don't think I'd done remove cookies in a couple of years, and I definitely noticed an improvement after I did it.
Okay.
But that's definitely a hit-or-miss thing, because you can lose a saved password and a cookie, and if you don't know the password, you're going to have trouble getting back in that website.
Okay. We'll talk about that in a minute, too. But in the meantime, we've got a couple of callers. A listener in Champaign is who we're going to talk to next, and this caller is on line one. Hello there. Line one?
Line one. I'm here.
You're there. Hi.
Hi. I've got a relatively old Mac. I recently upgraded from the operating system from 3.9 to 3.10, I think, or 3.4. I noticed the security is changing, or has changed on it. I used to be able to see in the upper part of the browser window, the shell, I could see the network settings, and if I had keys plugged into it, I could see those there. Now, I can see that if I'm in the administrator account. If I'm in a regular account, I can't see anything up there. And it appears that something's changed where they're not giving the regular user accounts that kind of access, so I can't do anything on a LAN. I sometimes don't see the data keys up there. Is that?
Do you mean normal? Like a USB key?
Yeah, and I did read some, but I did read some about security privileges, and it seems like there's just a super user, although not completely a super user, an administrator. I can do things in the administrator account, but I can't see the stuff in the regular user account that I used to be able to see. It doesn't seem like I've got complete access to everything. and I was playing around with settings for the data files, but it doesn't seem like I can add any user groups as I would be able to in Linux or Windows. Is there some concept that these are just the preformed user groups, the regular user and the administrative user?
Go ahead.
And it's not possible to add other groups and assign privileges to the other groups?
To a large degree, yes. While there is a Unix underpinnings for the macOS, they don't use groups the way you think of groups in Unix. On the other hand, the most current version of the operating system right now is 10.6.4. And if you're running something with a 3.9 in it, you're...
No, I'm not. No, I'm at 10.4, and that's where the change seems to have occurred. And I kind of understand maybe why they're trying to tighten up security, but it seems like it's gotten so tight for these regular users I can't do the things I need to do with it, and I can't find a way to add any kind of privileges to this regular user account.
Okay, you can do that. All right, so there's two or three things I'd suggest you check. If you're running a 10.4 version, first off, you want to think about upgrading to at least 10.5 because they don't really security updates for 10.4 anymore.
Except will 10.5 run on a PowerPC?
Yes. 10.6 will not, but 10.5 will.
I just had it over to Maxor, and what they installed a couple months ago was 10.4.
Unfortunately, however, Apple is no longer releasing updates for 10.4, so you're not going to get your security patches and other things like that. So you need to be a little careful about that. The first thing I'd suggest you do is under Disk Utility, there's an option to repair file permissions. A regular user should absolutely be able to read a mounted USB key, use the Wi-Fi, use the Ethernet at all times. To make changes to those settings, there's going to be a little lock icon, and you're going to click on that icon, and it'll prompt you to enter an administrator username and password to make the changes. But as far as actually using the network connection and using USB keys and stuff like that, that should just all work all the time.
I'm just using wired Ethernet.
That should just work. There's all users should have full access to that. So if it's not, there's definitely something that needs fixing.
Okay, so maybe I should take it back to the Apple Store and see.
Yeah, there's a Disk Utility program, and there's a repair file permissions. That fixes a lot of things, especially in the 10.4, especially early 10.4 versions. Often the file permissions would get set kind of wrong, and then your regular user wouldn't be able to do things. And it doesn't change anything but the file permissions. It basically works a lot like doing that in Linux would by hand with like a chmod command, since you seem to be a little familiar with Linux.
Okay, yeah, and but where's the utility is called what?
It's called Disk Utility. It's in Applications Utilities, and it's the same utility you'd use to reformat your hard drive, but one of the options on the main screen once you've clicked on the hard drive is to verify file permissions, and then also there's a repair file permissions.
Okay, got it.
That would be the first place I'd start, and if that doesn't get it, you might talk to the folks at the Apple Store, but you should be able to run 10.5 on a PowerPC, and at least you'll get your security updates, and they did constantly fix bugs and make things better, so.
Uh-huh. Okay, fine. Thanks for your help.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call. And next we take a call from a listener in Champaign on line 2. Hello.
Is that me?
That's you.
Thank you. I bought a new computer last fall with Windows 7, and I decided to clean up my email addresses shortly after I bought it. And I've had real problems with the address book, and specifically, it's very difficult to take something out, and the only way I found that you can edit, it says edit contact, but the only way that the edit really seems to work is just to remove the whole entry and lose all the stuff that's on it. And if it doesn't like what you've done, it parks any email sent to that address in Outbox, and I don't know how to get it out of Outbox. It grays out forward, so you can't do that. So it's a simple-minded problem, but it's really irksome.
Start with what mail program are you using? Are you using the one built into Windows 7?
Windows Live Mail.
Windows Live Mail, okay. Regarding the problem where they're stuck in the Outbox, I think that's because it's saying that the whatever you have listed as the two – in that message mm-hmm. is not a valid address to send
exactly.
mail to?
Exactly, yeah. And frequently it's because having to go through all this business of remove and retype, I have poor eyesight and I've made a typo someplace and it won't let me correct the typo either.
You should be able to just delete the entire, if you open up the mail that's in the outbox,
uh-huh.
you should be able to just go up to the contact, highlight it and delete the whole thing and then just type the email address from scratch. Just
okay.
And just the address part, not
well,
the
that,
name
that
or anything.
Is the only thing I found that will work. Is there
okay.
anything simpler?
Well, then the other part is to, I don't have a Windows 7 machine in front of me right now, but I believe that you can open up the address book separately from it's either separate from the mail application or it's at least separate from composing an email.
Yes, it is. That's
and
right. They call it contact.
Right. And you should be able to double click on a contact in there and it should open it up, let you make changes and save it.
Well, it says right click to interact and that brings up a menu that says edit contact, but it's the editing that I found so difficult. And so, but try double click rather than right click, huh?
Well, in general, possibly.
Okay.
I mean, if you're having a problem when it says you're trying to edit and it doesn't let you, I don't know. I'm not familiar enough with Windows Mail.
Okay.
I use Thunderbird and the Google interfaces. So I just off the top of my head, I don't know Windows Mail well enough to be able to answer that.
Okay.
If you can find a friend in the neighborhood that knows Windows, we're always, I think in the past that Debbie and I both recommended you find the neighborhood high school computer nerd that likes cookies and bake some cookies and have them come over and help you with that.
There you go. Okay, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call this morning. I suppose you could also go out on the web and, Google Windows Mail, right? And, put in your queries and see what comes up. One more question before we go to the next call here. Is there a way to, when you compose an email, you can set how large you want the type. But what about the boxes where you list your recipients? Can you make those larger so that you can see if you've typed in the correct?
That would be a system setting. Windows 7 actually has some settings under the display properties where you can say basically, this is different from changing the resolution of the monitor. So there's two ways. The older way that we would do this a lot would be we would just, let's say you had a 19-inch monitor and you normally would set the resolution to, 1600 by 1200 or something like that. And then somebody that had a problem with being able to see it, we would just change the resolution of the monitor to like 1024 by 768.
And then everything's
bigger, which means pictures don't fit and things like that. It depends. It depends on what the user wants, mm-hmm. whether we would do that. Windows 7 has added some stuff, and they could have been older. I just know I've helped a user with this recently with Windows 7, that under display properties, there's a zoom feature that only increases the size of text on the screen. And I think you can pick like 125%, 150%, 200%. And then the operating system, I believe, does have a built-in zoom feature, which is like a little zoom window. And as you move the mouse around and it magnifies, it actually is what it is.
Okay.
And there's also some third-party programs. I think it's called Text Zoom, possibly. Google for that. But I know I have some clients that have a third-party application because they also have somebody that works for them that has poor eyesight and they need the text to be really large to be able to work on the machine. But I would start with the going into the display properties on Windows 7 at least, and it could, like I said, it could be an older one also, and telling it to increase font size by like 125 or 150%. I don't know if Debbie has any way that we can do that on a Mac.
There's a couple different choices on the Mac. There's some system preference setting for people that have eyesight issues that they can just make anything bigger with mm-hmm. certain clicks that'll make anything change size. And then inside Apple Mail proper, that's the one I'm not so sure about. But I think you can adjust in composing. Boy, I'm not something I've never looked at. But you can, in general, make things bigger. Let's try
It would be. Did you say? Did you mention universal access?
It's called universal access in the Macintosh system preferences area.
Right.
To do stuff like auto to use keyboard commands or mouse clicks to magnify things temporarily and put them back.
Okay. Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana on line one. Hi. Line one.
Hello.
Hi there.
Yes. I seem to have lost some volume. I was wondering if you'd mind revisiting the memory upgrades for a moment. I recently upgraded an older computer, and I think I spent $40 a gigabyte for memory. It may have been as high as 50. And there are a couple of things to watch on buying. With the older computers, you do need DDR memory. And there are three speeds of DDR. Your computer will use the lowest speed. So if you buy a gigabyte of high-speed memory and you have the original 250 megabytes of low-speed memory, your new memory is going to operate at that low speed. So it might be better just to take it out.
Yeah, and you'll find some motherboards that only have two or four chips. So if you already have four in there, whatever, you're right. Instead of if it has like 256 meg chips and you buy gig chips, you might be better off just taking out the older ones. It depends on the motherboard. Sometimes, I mean, depending who built the machine, they may have used the fastest memory that machine would support anyway. So then you won't be able to buy memory that'll run faster on that particular motherboard either way, even if you take out the old. What I do personally, and then what I recommend to other people, is there's a company called Crucial.com, and you go tell them who made your computer, what model it is, or if it's just a motherboard. You say, I own this motherboard, and it says, here's the memory that we guarantee will work in your machine. And they have a great return policy if it doesn't work in your machine for some reason. I even ordered memory once and specified the wrong machine, so it was the wrong memory. And I fully admitted to them, and they said, mail it back, no problem, we'll mail you the right stuff.
Actually, they've got a program now that you can download, and it will look at the internals of your machine, and it will tell you exactly what's in there and precisely what you need. They're a great company. I'm glad you mentioned that. The computer I have is 10 years old, but it had a new motherboard about 3 years ago. So it will accept the highest speed memory, but we saved the old memory, which is, at the time the computer came out, it was the slowest of the DDRs. And I think I'm going to take the half gig that's left out and put two more gigabytes in. It really made a difference, and it was cheap. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Jim, you want to say anything else?
Well, regarding memory, I mentioned to the first caller, if you can actually see that your machine is utilizing almost all of its physical memory, which then in a modern operating system, the system will do what's called swap memory. It copies chunks of memory of data out of physical memory, that's the RAM, to what's called a swap file or swap partition on the hard drive. Hard drives are much slower than RAM. So anytime it has to actually utilize that swap file a lot, your machine will just, performance will just fall off the edge. So you try to, they still use swap files and it'll still exist, but if you see that your hard drive's continuously running just constantly when you're using the machine, that's a pretty good indication that it's having to swap a lot. And that's where you can go to Task Manager and say, okay, how much physical memory are you actually using? And if it says, I'm using 90%, you go, you know, maybe that $50 or $80 upgrade of memory is going to help me out, as opposed to spending $400 or $500 on a new machine.
Okay, let's take another call. Line three, Urbana. Hi.
Hi. About 6 weeks ago, I sent an email to UCLA to a professor, and the mail was blocked. And it was blocked by a company called Barracuda Central. I don't know if you're familiar with that. But they said the reason was that the client host, which was Express Sites, UIUC.edu, was poor, had a poor reputation.
Well, The best thing is I can tell you is to actually contact the on the site's webpage. There's contact information for getting hold of the people that run the express service. So they definitely would be able to give you the definitive answer on what's going on there. You can, and the poor reputation is not necessarily anything that the manager of the service can do about. They can try to retroactively go and fix it and convince people, hey, we're not really bad, we're not spammers. Mm-hmm. But what can actually happen is that you get spammers out there, and they send mail as you.
Mm.
And if the company that's receiving the mail doesn't verify that that message legitimately came from a certain server, the server it says it came from,
mm-hmm.
then you can give somebody else, that spammer, give somebody else a black eye.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get a poor reputation, and then you get mm-hmm. things where the Barracuda spam email spam box will then say that has a poor reputation,
mm-hmm.
and it won't go through.
Okay, is it my machine specifically, or is it sites or the university IP?
It's the actual Express mail server on campus.
Uh-huh.
If you send it
out
to Express.
If it actually replied back and told you that, then that's what it is.
Uh-huh.
And to get that fixed, when that happens, you should absolutely contact the Express mail people, because they would love to know when something like that has happened so uh-huh. that they can take action to try to fix it.
Okay. So, yeah, it's their IP address, 128.174.543. Okay, so it's just it's a relief that it's not my machine specifically, but it's something at sites.
Well, it's something that – it's not necessarily – so it's related to the site server.
Uh-huh.
But it could be that Barracuda got a lot of spam that said it was from site's
uh-huh.
Express server.
Uh-huh.
And so then the Barracuda Corporation sent out rules to the people that pay for the Barracuda spam service
uh-huh.
that said there's a highly likely chance that mail that comes from this server is spam.
Uh-huh.
If you choose to, you can just deny it and don't allow it, or you can – like in this case, it actually replied back to you and said, I didn't accept this mail, and this is why.
Uh-huh.
So it's not necessarily because spam is coming from sites, but it's certainly because there's spam out there that says it's from sites.
Uh-huh. Okay, and sites can do something about that.
There are things that mail administrators can do where they actually contact the companies
uh-huh.
That say that their servers are sending out spam, and they say, listen, we're not, and they work with them, and they can actually get those, what's called, like, it's a blacklist. They can get removed uh-huh. from the blacklist.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Next, we go to a listener in Chicago on line 4. Hi.
Hello. How are you? Well, I'm a sole user of this computer, and I like to have my recent documents. And every time I reboot the computer, the recent documents are not there. Is there a fix for that?
Recent documents in the Finder,
well, this
recent documents
PC,
in a...
and on the Start menu, there is a choice for My Recent Documents, and it'll list the documents that you've recently called up, such as Word documents.
Sure. What operating? Which PC?
XP.
XP. Okay. I wasn't aware that it actually cleared those when you rebooted, unless there's a possibility that there's some program actually doing that for you. I don't know that it's built into the operating system or not. So what, I mean, it could be your antivirus could be clearing something up, or if you have, like, I think it's called, like, Disk Washer or one of those things that clears up your Internet Explorer history.
Right.
Do you have anything like that?
Well, I do, and I use it. But sometimes I don't, because I don't want it to wipe out.
Well, I would make sure. I would go into the settings and make sure.
Let me just tell you quickly. The reason is that my ISP usually always goes down, so I have to reboot to reboot the modem, actually. So that's why I don't like to lose recent documents.
Sure. I would start with, if you have something like the Disk Washer or one of those programs that clears your Internet history, that you also go into it and make sure that it does not have a checkmark box next to something about clearing out recent documents. That would be the first place I would start. The other place would be is to Google. I'm not going to have time to go through all the results, but I type Windows XP clear recent documents, and I want to see if there's something where it says automatically, and then you'd go find that and uncheck that box if it's part of the operating system. But I would certainly start with any third-party tools you have for cleaning out your history.
Yeah, right. I know those are going to wipe them out, so... It's just that I don't run those programs when I know I want to get back to the documents I was working at.
Well, the question is if that program's actually always running in the background, and or on startup of the PC. That's the concern I have.
Yeah, it isn't. I actually have to manually start it.
Then I think the best one's going to have to be go to Google and if somebody's found an answer for it.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. This is Focus, and we're talking about computers today. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455. To follow up on the call about Barracuda, how does that happen that there you get spam that appears to be coming from you? Why does that happen? How do you avoid that? Can you avoid that?
You really can't avoid it. There's the mail protocol allows you to, when your mail client sends mail, it actually trusts you to say that I am this person. Mm-hmm. The mail's coming from me. And these spammers can just put in your email address mm-hmm. instead of their own.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they do that is because all their email addresses have been marked by Barracuda and other companies as being spam. So they know that they figure that your mail address actually sends out good mail. So they're going to send some spam.
For a little while.
And for a while, absolutely. And for a little while, their stuff's going to get through under your spam. It is a terrible thing to have happen to you. And it's gotten somewhat better as network administrators turned off bounce messages, like bouncing and says this message can't be delivered because it's an invalid username, because the spammers have a lot of invalid email addresses. When mail administrators stop sending out those messages and they stop sending out things, not all mail administrators send out messages that says we think your mail is spam. Because about 3 years, 3 or 4 years ago, this happened to me. Somebody took my main mail address and was spamming with it for over 2 weeks. And I was receiving over a couple hundred messages an hour saying, you sent us spam or that mail recipient is not valid. It was terrible. And then I actually had my ISP. Somebody contacted my ISP that received the spam. They contact my ISP. My ISP was going to cancel my service because they said I was sending spam. It was really bad.
What a nightmare. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
I had a question about some of the automatic backup software that's here advertised. I run a small business, and I travel a lot. I'd like to know that everything's backed up. So if I ever lose my laptop or my flash drive, then everything would be there. Is there anything you can recommend to look for in those services?
So you want off-site backup or?
Yeah, like Carbide is one I hear advertised a lot.
That's actually about the only one I know about that of an online backup. I don't know if Debbie knows of any brands. I do have a customer. I think it's Carbonite, I believe. I have a customer that's using it. It seems to be fine. The other way is if your Mac operating system has, now this is not online, it's an automatic backup, but it's physically plugged into your computer, or you can get the Apple Time Capsule. Macs have the Time Machine, which is a very handy backup tool. You just plug a drive in and say, yes, use it for Time Machine, and it just works. There's also, if you Google for it, there's at least one company that makes a similar thing for Windows that works really well. I've recommended it to my family and have it installed on a couple of their machines. But as far as online backup, Carbonite's actually the only one that I'm familiar with.
Okay, and no problems with that company?
I only have one customer on it, and they've never actually had to restore data yet, so I can't give a glowing review of it yet.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And next we go to a listener in Urbana, line 3. Hi.
Yes, just a further note on the address dealing. It's a bit more insidious than even you made it appear. Normally, they aren't stealing your address from your machine. They steal a list of addresses from a vulnerable machine and then use them. So there isn't very much you can do to protect yourself from this happening, except you should be using a firewall and antivirus software.
Yeah.
But, it's very nasty. I had it happen a few years ago and got some nasty letters back.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
thank you.
Thanks for that. Yeah, if you run into this problem, what do you do about it? How do you take care of it?
Well, if you're just an end user, you can send an email to your network, your mail administrator, and say this is happening, just so they know. They may know already, but just to let them know. And then you just hit delete a lot.
And you let your you let your spam blocker, because I have a couple domains of mine, and I constantly am getting emails saying your message could not be delivered to this weird address that I've never heard of that I never sent to. I mean, I see those constantly, and mostly because the original email would have gotten flagged as junk by my junk mail sorters. The response that includes that original also gets marked as junk, and I never have to see it. But yes, you get easily a few hundred an hour. You know, if I actually look at my mail logs, I get something like a few hundred pieces of mail an hour, most of which is spam.
Most of this stuff, in order for this to slow down and to prevent it from happening, it's actually going to have to be on the mail server side, your mail administrator of your ISP. They can do things with what's called SPF records that try to force people that they should actually check to make sure that the mail that you are sending is coming from the only servers that are actually authorized to send mail from you. And if they're not coming from those servers, then they should basically just treat it as spam to begin with. So as these things are built out and people adopt them and actually people require that an SPF record exists, we'll see less of this, we hope. Now, my guess is that just the spammers will do other things to get around it. They'll use botnets to take over your machine so that the mail is actually being sent from the correct server through your ISP and things like that. It's a cat and mouse game.
This is Focus, our guests this morning. Jim Irick and Debbie Flagger there with Campus Information Technologies and Educational Services at the University of Illinois. My name is Celeste Quinn. We've got about 6 minutes left. We maybe could take one more call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Debbie, a little bit earlier, you mentioned passwords, and if you clean out your cookies, you want to remember your passwords so that you can go back to the sites that you want to. Any advice for managing passwords?
Well, there's a number of programs out there that are secure password stores that you set a master password on it that you can't forget, because nothing works to get you in if you forget that password. And once you've set that master password, it can store the passwords to the different web pages you go to. And you can actually, the one I use, you can type notes, and it keeps it all encrypted on your hard drive. So it's there on your hard drive, but it's encrypted. If somebody else logs into your computer, breaks into your computer, steals your hard drive, unless they know that password, they can't get that data back out. You know, I can keep a good 10 to 20 passwords in my head, but that's about it at once. And you can, you know, you want to use
different... That's pretty good, Debbie.
Yeah, I'm thinking about five.
Yeah,
five plus my really hard one that I use for the passwords program.
Well, between the work passwords and the home passwords, and you know, good practice is my work computers don't have the same password on them my home computers do. You know, you can only remember so many passwords.
Right.
So when you've got computer accounts everywhere, you either need an algorithm or a program to manage it, or some way to make those passwords different, or something like single sign-on, which helps, where you have one master password and it works for everything. But that's not because you've set all the passwords the same. It's because they all go back to the same central way to find out who you are. And that's kind of an enterprise thing, not a home thing. So the program I happen to use, and I don't know that it's better or worse than anything else, is called 1Password. And it's got a Mac version and an iPhone version. And every once in a while, I launch the program and I tell my iPhone to find my Mac and sync to my Mac. And then I've got to type that really long password. It's a real pain on the iPhone, but once I get in, even if I've just got my phone with me, I can check the password. So if I'm trying to get in from someplace else, I know there are a number of other passwords.
I use a program called KeePass, KEEPASS. That's an open source, multi-platform system. I know it supports Windows, Mac, and I think it also supports Linux boxes. So, and I've been using that one for years. And then for sites, faculty, staff, students, or university faculty, staff, students, there's actually through the site's web store, there's at least Mac and Windows version that the university has paid for a license for of a password management program. And I'm not sure the name of it. If you go to the web store and type in password, I'm sure you'll be able to find it.
Okay. And we're here at the end of time now, but someone asked me to ask you guys again about energy conservation strips and how to hold the line on the amount your devices are sucking up in terms of electricity.
Well, there's certainly more. Google for it. There's more power adapters. I would keyword for me would probably be to say green power strip or something like
green
that.
Green power strip. Okay.
That would probably get you quite a few options, actually.
That does.
Okay, there
we
go.
I just typed it in. You get a lot of hits on that. Smart power strips helping stop idle current now. Belkin's green power strip and other colorful fall products.
Because somebody said, Celeste, I heard you ask Jim about this, but I can't remember what he said. And I said, I can't remember what he said either. So she said, would you please ask them again? And I said, yes, I will.
Certainly green power strips. And the other thing is I shut my machine off when I'm not using it at night. So when I'm done with the machine before I go to bed, I shut it off. Mm-hmm. And then if I use it the next day, I'll turn it on. I don't find that there's a problem. It certainly used to be an issue. It was called chip thermal creep kind of stuff where you shut a machine on and off and the chips would actually eventually migrate off the board. Whether or not how often that actually happened or if it's just an urban legend passed down from computer nerd to computer nerd, I'm not sure. But in general, modern machines, I've never experienced it on a modern machine. So I just shut mine off when I'm not using it because that's the best way to save power. One of the things I do, and not necessarily computer-related, but technology stuff, is, you know, I have a charger for my Kindle, I have a charger for my phone, I have a charger for my laptop. And what I do is I actually have a power strip next to where I charge those, and I turn the power strip on and plug whatever device I want in, and it charges. And when it's done charging, I shut that power strip back off. That way there's no what's called vampire draw. It's basically, it's just sitting there burning electricity when you're not doing anything with it.
Yeah, if you've ever touched one of those block power adapters that call them wall warts, they're hot, whether you've got something plugged in or not. If they're hot, they're using up electricity, right? And if you turn the power strip off, they won't be hot.
Right.
Or unplug them. Okay. Yeah, we've started being more careful at my house, too. You know, just every little bit knocks that power bill down one more notch.
Right.
The good thing is there are some companies that are developing USB chargers, which would work for a multitude of devices, because that's where most small personal electronics are heading, are just USB chargers, that detect when the device is plugged in and use virtually zero or actually zero electricity when the device is not plugged in charging.
Okay. There we've got to leave it. We're out of time. Jim, Debbie, thanks so much. And our next show on Focus about computers will be September 2nd.